Hello, everybody. This is the Gingerbread Man, and I would like to welcome you to my home. So thank you for showing up, and let's get on into it. Here on my show, we will discuss many things, some of them murky and confusing, some more relatable and straightforward. I am consumed with this excruciating interest in philosophy and asking questions as to when, what, why, and where things happen. I like history when it comes to context. I like looking at how things from the past relate to what we are considering now, especially when it comes to the avenues of empirical research, which would now be called science. Science being the dominant narrative that especially Western culture uses to create meaning systems for people to feel more comfortable in our lives. I like looking at how science has grown from less what some people would consider, quote, unscientific, unquote, upbringings, but have become more severe in their qualifications for declaring what is real or not. I like looking at religion. I like looking at spiritualisms. I like looking at cults. I like looking at altered styles of communication and depictions of reality. So there's this philosopher called Hegel, and in a very simplistic paraphrase of his ideas, basically you have the dominant culture, and then you have the counterculture. And for every dominant culture, there's always counterculture. And I always think of that as like this counterthinking. And there's always going to be a segment of any society that is choosing to believe off-the-wall theories such as flat earth, or for me, ghosts, you know, because I'm not a very skeptical person. But there's always these altered styles of theory to describe what reality is. And I like looking at how all of these things intermingle together and create these webs of understanding. And it's like these webs of understanding are like sunglasses that we see through. So everybody's seeing through different guises and different ways of looking at this thing called the world. Now, the world, being outside of this idea of me presently, everything that's outside of me is it, the isness of everything else, right? And a dominant part of my thought process and a lot of my thinking goes into this idea, this split, because what this does is it creates a duality where dualism is this creation of two entities, these two concepts that are separate from each other. They have space between them, you know, and everything in at least most languages, especially English, but almost every bit of gleaning of perception is put through this dual spectrum where there's an up and a down, or a hot and a cold, but there's this need to split one object, the world, into two things. And one of those fundamental splits is the fundamental split of personality when we create our individuality when we were children at some point, which I'm also confounded by, you know, because I'm a parent and I'm also obsessed with thinking about parenting and this relationship between father and son, or mother and son, or father and mother and son, or more than that, or fucking village if you want to interpret it that way. At some point in this process of becoming a sentient human, and a parent is a major part of that, we create this little self, this little independent operator of agency, this little being who decides things for him or herself And it give you a plant. You know, we can fucking grow a seed, and then all of a sudden we have a plant in a pot sitting on our desktop that I'm looking at that happens to be a yellow pot, and it's a weird cactus kind of thing. But like, I'm allowing this thing's existence here, so I'm a dominant part of it surviving, because if I stop giving it water, it's not going to survive in here, man. You know, and like, so as a parent, you know, we're fostering this new plant, this idea of individual selfness, this concept of I and me and all the things that are important to me that I'm going to hold on to for the rest of my life. You know, like, what's missing, especially in this Western type of culture, this American United States culture that I happen to be part of, is any concept of that fundamental split being complete horseshit. I know, like, if you've never listened to the show before, this might be a stretch, especially if you're not comfortable with a lot of Eastern ideologies and philosophies. But in Buddhism, you have this concept of Maya, which is illusion, where the world is empty. The way that we perceive the world from this vantage point outside of it, because we have to be outside of it to look at it, in a way, you know, but as soon as we make that split, we're part of a false game of illusion. And there's all these different plays that Maya, which is the goddess of illusion, puts on to play to keep people going. It's like the old the Matrix, you know, we're all plugged into different techno verses, and some people don't even want to leave because they get so used to it. You know, like in Taoism, which is one of my favorite philosophies, it's this non-dualism and non-action as being more real than what we interpret as real, which is all of our little mind games that we play with ourselves when we're making this life. But I digress. This isn't to discredit the illusion, I don't think, because I think the fundamental place to find as this creative element making your own selfhood, which you've been doing since you were a child, with or without influence from whatever parents you had, even though there probably was influence, that's just the part of it still. But you have been making this thing creatively yourself, and you have an immense impact over that, and that's crucial. So I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, especially in my own life. I think one of the biggest things I've been trying to get a wrangle on is figuring out how to enjoy my creation, because I have such a pessimistic spirit in me. And it's hard for me to hold on to interest sometimes. And I think that's a human thing, you know? But when loving the creation, you can't go full-blown ascetic, I don't think. That's one of the things that I kind of diverge. And I think about hedonism, which is pleasure-seeking from Epicurus and other, many others, is this philosophy of looking for pleasure. But as discussed in the last episode, I would like to focus on a much more satisfying pleasure and find the satisfaction with this creation, you know, which I want to enunciate again. The creation itself is my fabrication. It's like a fucking diorama in reality, but that's okay because it's pretty and I get to walk around in it, right? So it's this yet again, this dual thinking of being able to see it as empty but still cherish it as the most beautiful thing ever because you're making it. And if you don't cherish it, then what the fuck are we doing? Like, what are we doing if we can't find some semblance of joy even in work? Because we are fundamentally involved with it. Like, can anybody hear me when I say that? Like, this split between not wanting to do something and wanting it fundamentally is the biggest seed of disturbance emotionally that I think happens. Like, if there was never that thought of, oh, I like to do this, or I don't like to do this, then it would all, I feel like it would always be simple. And that goes back to the Tao Te Ching, where Lao Tzu said, you always want to start easy tasks before they become hard, and always respect hard, or always respect easy tasks as difficult while they're easy. And that, if that makes any sense. I kind of fumble through that. But basically, we have anything event, right? Quantum physics says every single thing that's measured is fragments of this flexing process that's perpetually moving and growing on, right? So every time we get a snapshot and take a picture, think about it, make a thought about it, make a judgment about anything we happen to be doing, we package and make this neat little event. It's like an event horizon with the fucking black holes and everything outside of it, you know, it gets eaten. But as soon as we have made these fragments and these events, we start categorizing them. And categorically, once we call something bad, we make it insufferable. And that's where the suffering is born. That's where the Buddhist dukkha comes from. That's the initial desire. It's a control scheme. And I think it's done so completely and so succinctly that it's an unconscious act that most people don't even see happening, especially me. Most of the time, I just think that I'm falling into some emotional situation. And I become completely ignorant of a lot of these things that I take as facts that I'm trying to expound right now. And I'm just trying to review a lot of my main ideas. I wanted to do that this episode. So that's kind of just what I'm doing here. I have one new idea I'm probably going to get into here in a second. But this is mainly what I believe, you know? And even though these are beliefs that I hold dear and I think about and I write about, and they're very important to me. I still fall into these situations in my head where I promote excess suffering that does not have to incur. And I think that is one of the most human acts, and I don't think I'm unique in doing it. You know, it's like knowledge itself, reading about stuff, even talking about stuff, this exchange of words that I love, my jhana yoga, which jhana being the expression of wisdom as a spiritual act or whatever. Like I'm trying to be helpful and I'm trying to spread these things that I believe wholeheartedly. Yet a lot of the times we fall off of whatever program we have subscribed to in some aspect. You know, I can wholeheartedly see that a lot of this is just ideology and it could be more miasma of illusion, like the Mara I was discussing about just now. It very well could be, but whatever diet plan we choose for ourselves that works the best is the one that we can stick to. And these are the beliefs that I feel that I've held closest for the longest amount of time. Blah, blah, blah. Enough of that. I see a lot of the times that most new episodes listened to of the show are the most recent one. And I want to be careful of how I present things. A lot of my ideas are pretty long drawn out, and that still took a little too long for my taste to express. And I still want to talk about something else and do a little bit of the book that I've been trying to read for the last couple of episodes. This might turn out to be a longer episode. But maybe I could condense it if I can be more efficient, like the good capitalists of my country. Oh well. But my biggest point is go find something that works for you or make your own. Make your own meaning system. It's a creative process. You make our own, we make our own realities. And I think it's a beautiful thing. And I would love to hear about it. You can talk to me about it. And email me at thegingerbreadmansdialogues@gmail.com or find the Facebook group, The Gingerbread Man's Dialogues, or The Gingerbread Man Podcast. I don't know. I'll look that up. I'll clarify that next episode. I know. I'm great. But before I get onto the book, I want to talk about something that I've been finding very, very interesting. And that's going to be this dude called Lucretius. This is where I'd have like a killer drum solo if I had a drum set in my room. I'd be like, dun, 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 dun. But Lucretius was basically an Epicurean philosopher, poet. He was basically trying to talk about philosophical theories and ideas in a poetic form, which is called prose. And Epicurus was a hedonist in some ways. He made like all these weird communes and cults where people would go try to live outside of society, and they would like make their own little communities that were supposed to be perfect, and it just all resonates with what we've been doing for thousands of years and still do now, and as far as cults go. But Lucretius exists a couple centuries after Epicurus, but he's very, very fond of the man's theories. One of the biggest parts of Epicurean theory that I have just been drawn to is this idea called atomism. And I've talked about it before on the show, but I've learned more about it now, and I feel like I'm starting to get the story more from the horse's mouth. But atomism comes from the term atomos, which is a Greek word, and Lucretius was Roman, but he was writing about Greek people. So these are Greek ideas, and the Roman gods and pantheon are adopted and absorbed from the Greek pantheon. And so basically, these atoms are indestructible little objects. And some atomists believed that these atoms were all identical. And this goes back to Leibniz, which was another philosopher from Europe, several centuries after all these people. But Leibniz had this idea called the monad. And a monad was an indestructible unit of existence. And the human soul was supposed to be a monad in form. I always get very confused by that man's theories. But Lucretius, and I'm assuming Epicurus, even though I haven't read Epicurus plainly, which I will do soon, Lucretius believed that these atoms were not all identical. He believed that there was a bunch of different types of atoms. And that was obvious because of the bunches of different types of arrangements of complex forms that we see in our solid existence. But take a solid object like a solid wall, or like a sturdy rock, or something that's unbreakable, like a steel bar. And all these things, according to him, even though they appeared to be solid, if you were to zoom in and see all their components, even solid objects were all these infinitesimally small objects interacting with each other and interchanging with each other and forming and reforming and breaking down and making all these crazy assortments of things, even in a solid object. It's just that their circuits or the ways that they're bouncing around is so tightly packed that you can't see it with your perceiving eye as far as you can sense it, which that just harkens to quantum mechanics, quantum physics, and all these other things I've been reading about science and the way that we're gleaning the microscopic world now, that I just can't help but just shake in my boots with excitement as I see all these parallels in context. Good God. Thank you for putting me here where I can see these things. So you have these infinitesimally small atoms, and there has to be a lot of different types of them because they're interchanging and making all these forms all the time. And so he had this complex cosmology. No. He had this complex system of like there's warmth atoms and these heat atoms or warmth atoms or whatever you want to call them were porous. And so smaller atoms could go inside the warmth atoms. And inside the warmth atoms, there's air atoms. And air atoms are static and they don't move. But then there's also wind atoms. So, like, I started to get lost because a lot of this system of thought, you could tell that they had absolutely no technology and no way to empirically prove it or measure things. But still, just using reason, just using rationale, it amazes me how close they got. Like, how close they got to what is becoming verifiably, at least mathematically verifiably, but eventually they're going to take pictures of these things. There's going to be technology to prove this shit, you know? But I don't think particles are going to be provable the smaller we get. And I think we're already getting to that place where this idea, this reductionist view that you can chop things in half forever, you know, and then inside the atoms, there's protons and neutrons. And inside the protons and neutrons, there's quarks. And then quarks make up mesons, and there's free photons that don't have weight, you know, like all these things that verifiably are starting to break down the reduction idea that you can keep getting little tinier Lego pieces that build things. You know, eventually, I think it's not going to be possible, and the math is already showing that, but I digress. Let's go back to Lucretius. Let's snap back 2,500 years. So another really cool part about his theories is this idea that there's this constant interchange of atoms. You know, like he describes a plant, and when a plant is growing, it's accruing atoms from its food because everything needs food. And so its roots are drawing up food from the ground. It's eating Mother Earth. And as it eats up the, it's physically drawing atoms into itself and then purporting it into growth, right? And then when it dies, it's because its life force starts to disintegrate, and then it starts to shed atoms, and it loses those atoms, and those atoms go and interact and build something else. Like, a lot of that's loosey-goosey, but some of it's strongly reminiscent of how we're looking at things empirically now. And he has this really cool illusion with an A, not illusion with an I. So an elusive story, where he's telling this story that's meant to mean something else, of how you have Father Sky, who's made of water, and then you have Mother Earth, and then the water hits the ground, you know, spontaneous regeneration of worms, because they didn't know where worms came from, or maggots. They didn't have a lot of understanding, but they still got damn close. But so the water hits the ground, and you have spontaneous regeneration of worms, but it's because the water has atoms of some life force that hit the earth atoms, and then they interchange and grow life. And of course, that's not true, but it kind of, you know, like there's still like a little bit of kindness in there. You know, you can't exactly say that they're on it, but still, there's a reason why we call atoms atoms now. And so interchange of life force, things just accrue and shed. And yeah, so illogically, in some way, he uses this to make a seeming, which two of my favorite philosopher scientist duo podcast guys, it's called The Dawdler's Philosophy. They always have this argument about the word seems, because if it seems to be something, that's intuitive. You're intuitively claiming something, and that's not empirically verifiable. And I would honestly say that I think some of the intuitions are more true than some empirical deductions sometimes, but I just don't think it's as clear cut. I don't think you can't use the word seems. But he says, he basically makes this intuition that since life is implied by this interchange, if you have atoms interacting, that life just seems to come out of it, right? And so since you have life here, he looked around and said that the universe is infinite. That it's not his place to say that there's boundaries, and he has all these statements about if you knew where the edge of the universe is, you'd have to stand outside of it to look at it and point at it. And so since you can never get outside of it, that's impossible to make a statement like that because it's infinite. And he calls it all that is. You know, so since there's atoms exchanging here, atoms probably have to be exchanging everywhere else as well. And that means that there's most likely other suns and there's other Earths. And on those Earths, there's probably more foods and other things making some sort of life, because life just seems to be implied from it. Now, one of the last bits of his theory that I want to speak about this morning is one of his more, well, he saves face because it's not completely atheistic. I said it's agnostic, but in Epicurean theology, the gods exist still, but they don't have any sort of degree of control. There's no watchmakers or architects. There's nobody creating or making things. Like, the world wasn't created by gods, if the gods do exist. This is very reminiscent of Hindu philosophy and theology as well, because for the Hindus, they have other realms of existence, and there's like these god realms, and because of reincarnation, if you're good enough, when you die, you could be reborn as a god. But there's not like a lot of those gods are coming down and making Earth, you know, like there's some primordial beings like Shiva and Brahman, you know, but like there's this depersonalization, whereas in especially Abrahamic faiths like Christianity and Judaism and Islam, when you have this monotheistic being, the old man with the beard who sits on the stone throne and makes all these judgments of who's good and bad and makes a hell so that everybody has to have, you know, eternal suffering for all these events that we incur. You know, there's this personalization of that kind of God. But for Epicurus, you know, these gods didn't do anything. And there's this strong belief that nature itself, this interplay between sky and earth, implies life and just grows it. And so he denotes nature as this main force. And the way that he uses to speak about nature reminds me of the Tao. It reminds me of Dharma. It reminds me of a lot of these other concepts that I'm used to seeing more often in Eastern side of things, in Eastern philosophies. But especially the further back you go when you look at some of these Western philosophers, another one of which I'd like to mention is Heraclitus, who I talk about him a lot. I know I've said it probably 1,000 times, but he said something about a river. And if you were a man stepping into, or a woman, if you're a person stepping into a river, you're never going to be the same person stepping into that river, and the river's not ever going to be the same river that you stepped in the first time, because it's always flowing forward. And this implies a process in things. And in quantum physics, there's a lot of these theories called S-matrix theories that basically are about how particles are consistently just falling apart, degrading. There's theories about in math behind it too, where protons inside atoms, which, so there's a solid form that the atom's making up, and it might be a fucking molecule, but inside those things, the proton will spontaneously degenerate into a free photon and another particle called a meson, and then it'll reform again. And so all the protons inside all these solid things are just falling apart. And like, there's like, it's so complicated even trying to picture how the fuck everything seems so real now. But yeah. So that's my presentation of some of Lucretius's presentation of some Epicurean ideas that I hope to research and learn more about in the future. I appreciate you listening. This is probably a hell of a lot more interesting than the first part of this episode where I was just talking about my ideas. Other people's ideas are really far more interesting, I think. But I digress. I'm going to go find Island, and then we'll read a couple more pages, but not too much because I've already dragged on too long. And then I'll find Odin, and he'll sign you off, and then I'll let you go for the week. And then I'll speak to you next time. So in case you haven't heard the first two parts of this, I'm reading the final chapter in Island by Aldous Huxley, which Aldous Huxley was a British writer back in the early to mid-1900s. He was a big influence to a lot of the people who were influenceable in the countercultural movement of the 60s and the 90s that spread across the entire world and involved psychedelias that I feel that we are in a second renaissance of now. I feel like we're in the second wave, especially when it comes to psychedelia and the freedom of every person to experiment with their mind the way that they see fit, and to experiment with ideologies too, not just chemicals. And there's just this sense of freedom and experimentation and newness that was just palpable during that time period, even though I wasn't to be born for another 25 years, 30 years, realistically. But he was very, very big deal to me. And so here goes. We're about 2/3 of the way through the book. And I don't think context really matters, kind of. He's taken the moksha medicine, which the moksha medicine is a toadstool. It's a mushroom, most likely psilocybic mushrooms, that would open the mind of the people of this island country called Pala that this outsider has chosen to visit named Will. And he's been describing and experiencing the substance through the narrative that Huxley just beautifully portrays. And in this, where I'm starting now, he's sitting in a bed and he's looking at a scary lizard who's freaking him out because he's had his eyes closed for a long time and he's seen all this craziness. And then all of a sudden he sees a lizard and it shakes him out of his wonderment and awe. And he starts to feel the negativity of existence. He starts to feel fear, and it's captivating. Here we go. Their bluish pallor was barred and veined with pink, and the wings that fluttered continuously like petals in a breeze were shaded at the edges with a deepening violet, a mimicry of flowers. But the insect forms were undisguisable, and now even the flowery colors had undergone a change. Those quivering wings were the appendages of two brightly enameled gadgets in the bargain basement, two little working models of nightmare, two miniaturized machines for copulation. And now one of the nightmarish machines, the female, had turned the small flat head, all mouth and bulging eyes, at the end of its long neck, had turned it, and, dear God, had begun to devour the head of the male machine. First a purple eye was chewed out, then half the bluish face. What was left of the head fell to the ground, unrestrained by the weight of the eyes and jaws. The severed neck waved wildly. The female machine snapped at the oozing stump, caught it, and while the headless male uninterruptedly kept up his parody of Ares in the arms of Aphrodite, methodically chewed. Out of the corner of his eyes, Will glimpsed another spurt of movement, turned his head sharply, and was in time to see the lizard crawling toward his foot. Near, near. He averted his eyes in terror. Something touched his toes and went tickling across his instep. The tickling ceased, but he could sense a little weight on his foot, a dry, scaly contact. He wanted to scream, but his voice was gone, and when he tried to move, his muscles refused to obey him. Timelessly, the music had turned into the final presto. Horror briskly onto the march. Horror in rococo fancy dress leading the dance. Utterly still, except for the pulse in its red throat, the scaly horror on his instep lay staring with expressionless eyes at his predestined prey. Interlocked. The two little working models of a nightmare quivered like windblown petals and were shaken spasmodically by the simultaneous agony of death and copulation. A timeless century passed. Bar after bar, this gay little dance of death went on and on. Suddenly, there was a scrabbling against his skin of tiny claws. The bloodsucker had crawled down from his instep to the floor. For a long lifespan, it lay there absolutely still. Then, with incredible speed, it darted across the boards and onto the matting. The slit-like mouth opened and closed again. Protruding from between the champing jaws, the edge of a violet-tinted wing had fluttered, like an orchid petal in the breeze. A pair of legs waved wildly for a moment, and then they disappeared from view. Will shuddered and closed his eyes. But across the frontier between things sensed and things remembered, things imagined, the horror pursued him. In the fluorescent glare of the inner light, an endless column of 10 bright insects and gleaming reptiles marched up diagonally from left to right out of some hidden source of nightmare towards an unknown and monstrous consummation. I'm sorry, I'm not the best at reading out loud. Ganglius gangliotis by millions, and in the midst of them, innumerable bloodsuckers, eating and being eaten forever. And all the while, fiddle, flute, and harpsichord, the final presto of the fourth Brandenburg kept trotting timelessly forward. What a jolly little rococo death march. Left, right, left, right. And what was the word of command for hexapods? And suddenly, they weren't hexapods any longer. They were bipeds. The endless column of insects had turned abruptly into an endless column of soldiers, marching as he had seen the brown shirts march through Berlin a year before the war. Thousands upon thousands of them, their banners fluttering, their uniforms glowing in the infernal brightness like floodlit excrement. Numberless as insects, and each of them moving with the precision of a machine, the perfect docility of a performing dog. And the faces, the faces. He had seen the close-ups on the German newsreel, and here they were again, preternaturally real and three-dimensional and alive. The monstrous face of Hitler, with his mouth open, yelling, and then the faces of assorted listeners, huge idiot faces, blankly receptive, faces of wide-eyed sleepwalkers, faces of young Nordic angels wrapped in the beatific vision, faces of Baroque saints going into ecstasy, faces of lovers on the brink of orgasm, one folk, one realm, one leader, union with the unity of an insect swarm, knowledgeless understanding of nonsense and diabolism. And then the newsreel camera had cut back to the serried rank, the swastikas, the brass bands, the yelling hypnotist on the rostrum. And here once again, in the glare of his inner light, was the brown insect-like column marching endlessly to the tunes of his rococo horror music.
Onward, Nazi soldiers. Onward, Marxists. Onward, Christian soldiers and Muslims. Onward, every chosen people, every crusader and holy war maker. Onward into misery, into all the wickedness, into death. And suddenly Will found himself looking at what the marching column would become when it had reached its destination. Thousands of corpses in the Korean mud. Innumerable packets of garbage littering the African desert. And here, for the scene kept changing with bewildering rapidity and suddenness. Here was the five fly-blown bodies he had seen only a few minutes ago, faces upward and their throats gashed in the courtyard of an Algerian farm. Here, out of a past almost 20 years earlier, was that old woman, dead and stark naked in the rubble of a stucco house in St. John's Wood. And here, without transition, was his own gray and yellow bedroom, with a reflection in the mirror on the wardrobe door of two pale bodies, his and Babs, frantically coupling to the accompaniment of his memories of Molly's funeral and the strain from Radio Stuttgart of the Good Friday music of Parsifal. The scene changed again, and festooned with 10 stars and fairy lamps. Aunt Mary's face smiled at him gaily, and then was transformed before his eyes into the face of the whining, malignant stranger who had taken her place during those last dreadful weeks, before the final transformation into garbage. A radiance of love and goodness. And then a blind had been drawn, a shutter closed, a key turned. In the lock, there they were, she in her cemetery, and he in his private prison, sentenced to solitary confinement, and one unspecified fine warning to death. The agony in the bargain basement, the crucifixion among the Christmas tree decorations, outside or in, with the eyes open or with the eyes closed, there was no escape. "No escape," he whispered. And the words confirmed the fact, transformed it into a hideous certitude that kept opening out, opening down into depth below depth of malignant vulgarity, hell beyond hell of utterly pointless suffering. And this suffering, it came to him with the force of a revelation, this suffering was not merely pointless, it was also cumulative, it was also self-perpetuating. Surely enough, frightfully enough, as it had come to Molly and Aunt Mary and all the others, death would come also to him, would come to him, but never to this fear, this sickening disgust, these lacerations of remorse and self-loathing. Immortal in its pointlessness, suffering would go on forever. In all other respect, one was grotesquely, despicably finite. Not in respect to suffering. This dark little inspiciated clot that one called I was capable of suffering to infinity, and in spite of death, the suffering would go on forever. The pains of living and the pains of dying, the routine of successive agonies in the bargain basement, and the final crucifixion in a blaze of tin and plastic vulgarity, reverberating, continuously amplified, they would always be there. And the pains were incommunicable, the isolation complete. The awareness that one existed was an awareness that one was always alone, just as much alone in Babs' musky alcove as one had been alone with one's earache or one's broken arm, as one would be alone with one's final cancer, alone, when one thought it was all over, with the immortality of suffering. He was aware all of a sudden that something was happening to the music. The tempo had changed. Rallentando. It was the end. The end of everything for everyone. The jaunty little death dance had piped the marchers on and on the edge of the cliff, and now here it was. And they were tottering on the brink. Rallentando, rallentando. The dying fell and fall into dying, and the punctually inevitably here were the two anticipated chords, the consummation, the expected dominant, and then fini, the loud, unequivocal tonic. There was a scratching, a sharp click, and then silence. Through the open window, he could hear the distant frogs and the shrill, monotonous rasp of insect noises. And yet, in some mysterious way, the silence remained unbroken. Like flies in a block of amber, the sounds were embedded in a transparent soundlessness, which they were powerless to destroy or even modify, and to which they remained completely irrelevant. Timelessly, from intensity to intensity, the silence deepened. Silence, an ambush. A watching, conspiratorial silence, incomparably more sinister than the grisly little Rococo death march which had preceded it. This was the abyss to whose brink the music had piped him, to the brink and now over the brink and into this everlasting silence. "Infinite suffering," he whispered. "And you can't speak, you can't even cry out." A chair creaked, silk rustled. He felt the wind of movement against his face, the nearness of a human presence. Behind his closed lids, he was somehow aware that Suzilla was kneeling there in front of him. An instant later, he felt her hands touching his face, the palms against his cheeks, the finger on his temples. The clock in the kitchen made a little whirring noise, then started to strike the hour. 1, 2, 3, 4. Outside in the garden, a gusty breeze whispered intermittently among the leaves. A cock crowed, and a moment later, from a long way off came an answering call, and almost simultaneously another and another, then an answer to the answers and more answers in return, a counterpoint of challenges challenged, of defiances defied, and now a different kind of voice joined in the chorus. Articulate but inhuman. Attention, it called through the crowing and insect noises. Attention, 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 Suzilla repeated, and as she spoke, he felt her fingers starting to move over his foreheads. Lightly, lightly from the brows up to the hair, from either temple to the midpoint between the eyes, up and down, back and forth, soothing away the mind's contractions, smoothing out the furrows of bewilderment and pain. Attention to this. And she increased the pressure of her palms against his cheekbones and her fingertips above his ears. To this, she repeated, to now. Your face between my two hands. The pressure was relaxed. The finger started to move against his forehead. Attention. Through a ragged counterpoint of crowing, the injunction was insistently repeated. Attention. 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 The inhuman voice broke off in mid-word. Attention to her hands on his face. Or attention to this dreadful glare of the inner light, to this uprush of tin and plastic stars. Through the barrage of vulgarity, to this packet of garbage that had once been Molly, to the whorehouse-looking glass. To all those countless corpses in the mud, the dust, the rubble. And here were the lizards again, the Gonglioides gonglioides, by the millions. Here was the marching columns, the rapt, devoutly listening faces, Nordic angels. Attention! The minor bird began to call again from the other side of the house. Attention! Will shook his head. Attention to what? To this. And she dug her nails into the skin of his forehead. This, here and now. And it isn't anything so romantic as suffering and pain. It's just the feeling of fingernails. And even if it were much worse, it couldn't possibly be forever or to infinity. Nothing is forever. Nothing is to infinity. Except maybe the Buddha nature. She moved her hands and the contact was now no longer with nails but with skin. The fingertips slid down over his brows and very lightly came to rest on his closed eyelids. All right, that's about enough for today. Go grab it. Be right back.
Hello, it's Ask O and the Gingerbread Man again.
Well, oh boy.
It's been a long time since I actually, me and my dad did this.
It's been 2 weeks. It's been a long time. Took 1 week off.
Okay, it is just, didn't feel like it. But how are you guys doing?
How are you doing?
It's been 1 week since, you heard me.
1 whole week? What'd you do in that week?
Pretty much this. I forgot, okay?
That's okay. Sometimes the best thing you can do
is not.
Is just forget all the useless crap, I guess. It'll be there.
Yeah, but what if the useless stuff is actually good stuff?
That's another good point. Maybe there's not any useless information, huh?
Well, but what if the useless information is actually good?
That's a good point. Maybe all.
That's actually a big point.
That is a good point. Maybe you need to think about that too.
Yeah, sure.
All right. Have a good night. Bye.
Bye.